morning, everybody. So before I start today, I want to acknowledge that I do a lot of repetition. I review a lot of the stuff that we've already talked about, but I do it for a reason. I just wanted to acknowledge that, and thank you for bearing with me during that. I do it for a reason. One, in repetition, we can learn. You know, there's a benefit in that regard. And so that's one reason I do it. In addition to that, I do it just in case there's anybody new who doesn't really know what we're talking about. I don't want them to walk in here and be like, what? Because as it is, just my speaking has that effect on people. So I try to minimize the blow as much as possible. So with that being said, we're in a series called Life Change from the Heart, as Kevin said. And when we kicked off that series 13 weeks ago, Kevin said that life change begins from the heart, that it begins as we begin to learn what it means and to practice what it means to live by the Spirit. Galatians 5, 16 to 17 and 22 to 23 say, "So I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the sinful nature." That is, when you live by the Spirit, you're free to change. "For the sinful nature desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit, what is contrary to the sinful nature. They're in conflict with one another, so much so that you can't do the very things you want to do. But the fruit of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control." So the deeper we grow within the Spirit, the deeper is our experience of the Spirit's fruit. And this is what God wants in our lives. John 15, 5 and 8 say, Jesus says, "I am the vine. You are the branches. If a man remains in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. And this is to my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples." So the idea is, the more that our hearts experience fulfillment in the vine, in the Spirit, the less we need to pursue fulfillment anywhere else. Because a deep experience of things like love, joy, peace, and faithfulness, that's what we're really after anyway, as we pursue those other things. So as this need is being met in our hearts, we're free to change by the fulfillment that comes by the Spirit. In this regard, life change really does come from the heart. It comes from the heart's fulfillment. So the question then, of course, becomes, what does it mean to live by the Spirit? What does it mean to be in the vine, to remain in Jesus? To help us explore this, we said that for this series, we're going to be using the 12-step framework developed by Dr. Bob and Bill W., the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, to help us with this. But as we do this, we said that we are going to focus not on the steps necessarily themselves, but on the gospel which inspired them, the gospel which inspired their writing. And by doing this, we eliminate the idea that this is a sermon series about addiction or something like that. Instead, what we use this 12-step framework for is we use it as a guide to walk us through the gospel, to focus our attention in a certain order. And in addition to that, we use this 12-step framework as a practical means to understanding what it means to work out the gospel in our lives as we walk through each part of the gospel. However, we can't dismiss the reality of how powerful it is when one devotes herself to the gospel using this framework. The experience of the Spirit can be so powerful that it can free one from the clutches of death and insanity, the very byproducts of addiction. So as we began looking at this framework, we first recognized that, like the Apostle Paul, every single one of us is equally powerful to sin when we're apart from the Spirit. Following this, we began to take a deep look, a deep dive into what it means to live by the Spirit. And we said that what it was is it kind of all boiled down to this journey, this ongoing journey of the heart's devotion, first, to loving the Lord with all our hearts, which is the first and greatest commandment, and second, to loving our neighbor as ourselves, which is the second greatest commandment. And we said that it was okay to do this because in Matthew 22, 36 to 40, Jesus says that all the law and all the prophets hang on those two very commands. So it's okay to think of this as a journey in that regard. So beginning with the first and greatest commandment, we liken this portion of the journey to cleaning the inside of a cup. We describe this cup cleaning process as one which teaches us what it means to search our hearts for self-indulgence so that we can present as much as possible to God for him to remove from our hearts, to make as much room as possible within our hearts, which is what the cup represents, for his love, for his grace, to be devoted to him. So that cup cleaning process is actually nothing more than a practical devotion to the greatest commandment. It's about giving more of your heart to the Lord. And it was the basis for steps 4 through 7. After this, last week, we shifted our focus from pursuing the greatest commandment to pursuing the second greatest commandment. And that's where we're going to pick up today. And what I'd like to point out to you is that what you're going to recognize is this is actually a Christmas sermon. And I'll come back to that at the end. But think about it in that regard. So last week, when we started talking about this, we took a look, a really deep look, at Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, in which he explains what it means to approach obedience from the heart, as opposed to this diligent observance of his law. To do so, he begins by first demonstrating the impossibility of pursuing righteousness by the law alone. And to do that, he uses what seems like a really simple law, one that anybody should be able to follow without failing. He uses the law against murder as an example of how impossible it is. He says, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder.' And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is even angry with a brother or sister will be subject to the same judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raca,'" something that all of us say, "is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in the danger of the fire of hell." It's impossible to meet those requirements. So Jesus follows this reality about the impossibility of righteousness through obedience with the right way to pursue obedience, with the way to approach it from the heart. And when he does this, he does it in the context of having already addressed the first commandment, of having already addressed the position of the heart for the Lord. He says, "Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift." So to address the greatest commandment, Jesus sets the scene for where all of this takes place at the altar, the place where one goes to offer their devotion and sacrifice to the Lord. So when we're at the altar, after we've completed steps 4 to 7, after we've addressed the inside of the cup, we're now ready to move on to the second greatest commandment, because that's all that remains. Remember, all the law and all the prophets hang on those two commandments. So if you've already addressed the position of your heart for the Lord, all that remains is love for your neighbor, the second greatest commandment. And how does Jesus tell us to do that? What should that look like? The first thing he wants us to do is pursue reconciliation with those that we've wronged. And this is at the very heart of steps 8 and 9, what we're going to talk about today. So step 8 reads, "We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Step 9 says we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So just what is this reconciliation stuff? What does it look like? Just to make sure that we're all on the same page, we're going to see what our good friend Mr. Dictionary has to say. reconcile, to reestablish a close relationship between, to settle or resolve. Reconcile, to become friendly with someone after estrangement, or to reestablish friendly relations between two or more people, to make two apparently conflicting things compatible or consistent with each other. So, given these definitions, I think it's fair to say that reconciliation with someone else is all about pursuing harmony within that relationship. But what's the right way about doing this? If I were someone who was devoted to the law and I were sitting in attendance at Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, my mind might immediately take me to Torah, to Numbers chapter 5, verses 5 to 7, which say, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Say to the Israelites, when a man or woman wrongs another in any way, and so is unfaithful to the Lord, that person is guilty and must confess the sin he has committed. He must make full restitution for his wrong. Add one-fifth to it and give it all to the person he has wronged.'" Well, that sounds kind of mechanical, kind of mathematical, right? And I don't think that this is what Jesus was referring to when he said to go be reconciled. Remember, earlier in that sermon, he had just finished preaching that obedience to the law should be approached from the heart, not as a legalistic devotion to its letter. But how could anybody possibly know what that means apart from the law at that time? In the case of pursuing the greatest commandment, Jesus presented us with the right way to do this. He did so as he contrasted the right way to do this against the wrong way to pursue lordship, against a way that's spiritually blind or hypocritical. He said to approach it by cleaning the inside of the cup. He gave us a practical thing to do, to search our hearts. In this case, however, he doesn't offer any suggestions. He just says, go and be reconciled. So what or who could we possibly model our approach to reconciliation after? Well, given that earlier in his Sermon on the Mount, he said that he has come to fulfill the law, and given that in doing so, he reconciles humanity to God, I think it's fair to say that we should model our approach after Jesus. Consider Romans 5, verses 6 to 11. "You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrated his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his Son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? Not only is this so, but we also boast in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation." So this idea that we should model our pursuit of reconciliation after Jesus is made even clearer when we consider the gospel according to John, where in chapter 13, verses 1 to 17, it says, "It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end." So imagine the gravity of this moment. The suffering that was to come by Jesus' crucifixion had now occupied his awareness. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So the dominoes were all lined up. They were all in place, and the first domino had been tapped, setting off the whole sequence of events. Imagine what it would feel like to be Jesus, watching those events unfold, watching that pattern of dominoes tumble over, knowing that the last domino was his crucifixion, something that he never deserved. So what does Jesus do in this very moment as he watches this? So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You don't realize now what I'm doing, but later you'll understand." So this act of washing his disciples' feet is something symbolic, something that represents something later to come. "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." So whatever it is that this washing of the feet symbolizes must be really important, because without it, we have no part with Jesus. "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "Those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him. And that was why he said, "Thought not every one of them was clean." When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you not understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is who I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." So Jesus washes his disciples' feet as something symbolic that was to come. So given that he did this amidst the awareness of his crucifixion, I think it's fair to suggest that washing his disciples' feet symbolized his death on the cross for humanity. It symbolized the sacrifice he took upon himself for the sake of reconciling humanity to the Father. But Jesus doesn't just wash their feet so they'll have something to remember his sacrifice. He washes their feet so that they can remember that they are to wash one another's feet, that they are to pursue reconciliation with one another in the same way that he did. So if we're going to model our pursuit of reconciliation after Jesus, what should it look like? Well, let's consider the path that Jesus took to reconciliation, the path that he took to his crucifixion after washing his disciples' feet. John 19 says, "Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again saying, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they slapped him in the face." Jesus' willingness to pursue reconciliation came at the expense of being beaten, of being mocked, humiliated, and ridiculed with a crown of thorns. As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify! Crucify!" In spite of his own people calling for his torturous death, he marched on toward crucifixion so that even his very accusers might be reconciled to his Father. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There, they crucified him. This act of crucifixion is gruesome. Nails were driven through his flesh so that he could be affixed to a wooden cross. Can you imagine the horror of somebody holding a nail to your flesh? The horror of watching them take aim, and the horror of them then driving that nail through your flesh into a piece of wood. Can you imagine gravity pulling the weight of your body down against those nails? Can you imagine being hung in this way until death finally came by asphyxiation? Jesus didn't just accept this, he pursued it. He pursued it so that our relationship with God might be brought to harmony, that we might be reconciled through faith in what only he could do. So that's the type of willingness we're to have as we pursue reconciliation. That's the degree of humility we're to demonstrate within our hearts. Notice how Jesus didn't curse his accusers, even though he knew he did nothing to deserve this. The only thing that he focused on as he marched on was their need to be reconciled. This is what our hearts need to focus on. It's reconciliation that is most important, not whether we're right or wrong. Even if harm was committed against us by the other person, we're not to dwell on it. In fact, don't even bring it up. Instead, crucify your pride, even at the expense of being ridiculed by others. So Jesus models what the pursuit of reconciliation should look like. He demonstrates that it should be pursued sacrificially, at our own expense, not at the expense of others. He demonstrates that it should be pursued with total humility, at the expense of our pride. He demonstrates that it should be pursued with mercy, that even if the other person has done wrong and we're in the right, we should march on. He demonstrated that this is what love looks like, and this is how we should love others. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. A new command I give you, love one another. Just as I have loved you, so you must love one another. It's by this that everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. So what does all of this look like in terms of our step work? What does it look like in terms of step 8 and step 9? Well, step 8 is all about preparing the heart with humility. As we consider the harm that we've caused others, and that preparation is largely about focusing only on the harm that we caused, not at all on the harm that the other person caused. It's about giving them the benefit of the doubt that they were innocent. It's about starting to crucify my pride for the sake of reconciliation, because it's reconciliation that really matters. So when I did this, the first thing that I had to do for this step is I had to make a list of all the people I had harmed, which is what the wording of the step says. And I had to list with each person the harm that I caused. This was actually pretty easy, because when I did that examination during the cleaning of the inside of the cup, I wrote a lot about these things, about the harm that I caused. And I talked about them with my sponsor as I confessed them to him. After creating this list, my sponsor reviewed it. He wanted to make sure that the list wasn't too long, that I was really focusing on true harm, not superficial or trivial arguments or disagreements, but things that were really harmful. That's one of the values of having somebody who's been through this. So he went through it, and he made sure that I wasn't setting up these meetings to seem really pious in front of these other people. That meant that he had to remove from the list all of the ladies who'd been absolutely, positively devastated when we broke up. Why do you guys laugh? One of the general rules about making amends is you don't actually pursue them with former romantic interests. That's just a disaster waiting to happen. You actually go about pursuing that type of amends in a completely different way. So after my sponsor reviewed my list, all of a sudden my list became too short. He asked me, why is there nobody from your immediate family listed on this list? And so I explained to him, look, the majority of the havoc that I wreaked happened after I moved away from home. thousands and thousands of miles away from my parents and family. Apart from only a handful of instances, no more than 6 or 7, there was no way my parents could have known what was going on with my life. Not a chance. My sponsor insisted that they knew. He also insisted that even my sisters were hurt. Come on now, my sisters too? Not a chance. My sponsor suggested that at the very least, because we share the same parents, they must have been hurt in that regard. So after I finalized the list with him, I now had to go revisit the harm that I had listed, and I had to write about it using this particular writing format, which is projected on the screen behind me. And I'm going to apologize right now. I was completely envisioning whipping out the laser pointer and being like, in the first column, you list the name of the person you harmed. I forgot the laser pointer in my garage. Forgive me, my brothers and sisters. So that's what happens in the first column. In the second column, you'll notice that it's divided in a top and a bottom. At the top of the second column, I list the specific actions, the specific things that I did, which resulted in harm. So using my parents as an example, within this top portion, I was to list the specific things that I did which might lead them to believe that their son, their child, had a problem with drugs or alcohol. So I listed the handful of items that I could recall, no more than 8 or 9. For the section beneath this, I was to list the types of harm that these actions might have caused. So the type is the top is the stuff that I specifically did. The bottom is the harm that resulted. Regarding my parents, my sponsor challenged me to be as harsh as possible on myself. He made sure I included things like causing them to fear that they may suffer the loss of a child due to alcoholism, causing them to think that in spite of doing the best they could to raise a child, that child not only rejected their love, but responded with hatred, causing them to think that the child they slaved for so that he could have a college education, something that they were never afforded, that he took that and wasted it and had no regard for the suffering. In filling out this portion, I was to assume the worst consequences for my actions within reason. And as I did this, I wasn't allowed to consider anything that they might have done wrongfully. I wasn't allowed to focus on any context which made me look justified. To do so would eliminate the humility from my heart. So now moving over to the third column, I was to assume they were completely innocent and consider what types of things they might think of a person who did everything I just listed in the second column. What types of names would they call such a person? I was to do, then in the bottom half of that column, I was to do my best to try to describe what it would feel like if I were an innocent bystander and somebody did those things to me. For this one, my sponsor essentially had me define words like rage, torment, devastation. He wanted me to get at the essence of those words, not to just simply list the words themselves. How painful would it be to fear that your own child could be killed? I had to do this for every person on the list. Once I'd done my best to put myself in their shoes, now I had to write a script that I would be reading at the amends. And what mattered most about this script is that I focused on these key elements. First, I had to explain that I was working a program of recovery because I was an alcoholic. If it was appropriate, I could share with them the type of stuff that I'd been doing. Second, I was to explain that part of this program requires me to consider the harm I've caused others. Third, I needed to explain that if I didn't go through with this, it could jeopardize my recovery. Fourth, I needed to acknowledge the harm that I caused each person. And as I did this, I needed to do it in a way which didn't cause even more harm, which didn't open up an old wound or create a new one. I was to exclude any form of justification for what I did. There was to be no explaining. Fifth, instead, I was to acknowledge the fact that I could never truly understand the reality of the harm that I had caused. Sixth, I was to acknowledge that I didn't deserve to be forgiven and understood if I wasn't. Seventh, I was to ask for forgiveness. And eighth, I was to conclude with silence, allowing them to forgive me or not forgive me, to speak or not to speak. If there was awkwardness, I needed to let it persist. All that mattered was preparing my heart for reconciliation. So you might be thinking to yourselves, wait a minute, what happened to all that stuff with the three columns? How come none of that was in the script? Well, that particular portion was about getting my heart ready. The script portion was about getting my mind ready. That's the way that I prepared to make amends to them and demonstrated my willingness. So I rehearsed these scripts, and my sponsor reviewed them. The expectation wasn't that I was going to take the script with me and mechanically read it to the person I was making amends with. And the expectation wasn't that I was going to memorize everything on the script. The expectation that I was going to do my best to try to remember those 8 key points. That was the purpose of it. So getting all of those scripts taken care of and reviewed and rehearsed, next I needed to set up appointments with these people. I needed to communicate with them that I had something really important to talk about and that this should happen in private or at least in a place where there wouldn't be any distraction, that it was really important. After that, all that remained was making the amends, which is the work of the ninth step. So I can't tell you how huge it was for me to be led through this by a sponsor, by somebody who himself had been led through this. He was able to walk me through and coach me on what is and isn't harm, on what types of things will actually cause more harm and to avoid. In addition to this, I was really grateful that this step came real late in the process, that it came after I addressed the inside of my heart, that I had the opportunity to really understand the way self-indulgence once filled my heart, to have the opportunity to let God remove that and instead replace it with his grace. Not only was that really valuable, but the time it took was also really valuable. Because as I met with these people, it wasn't as though I was just coming with yet another empty plea for forgiveness out of reactive shame because I'd messed up again. Instead, they had time to watch that I was changing, that this time it was something different, that it was important. So when it came time to do the first amend with my mom, which she wasn't the very first one I did, but when it came time to do amends with her, I bought a plane ticket and flew home. And when we set up this meeting, I envisioned her picking this beautiful place, which was going to have significance in my life forever, as I recalled it. Instead, she picked the garage in her car with the garage door open. So I began. And after doing my best to say the portion as I had prepared it, we sat there in her car in silence. It seemed like an eternity of silence before she finally spoke. With tears in her eyes, she said she forgave me, but that she had just one question for which she wanted a truthful answer. Of course, I said. She looked me in the eyes and said, "Mijo, what really happened to the car?" What? I was totally confused. What the heck are you talking about? What car? What do you mean? You know, the car that was stolen when you were in high school. What really happened to it? I couldn't believe it. This was her one question. I poured out my heart and humbled myself before her, and this was the only thing she cared about? So, I did my best not to sound like the brat I was when it really happened. And I told her, "Mom, believe it or not, when it happened, this was one of the few times I was telling the truth. It really was stolen." "Okay," she said, and got out of the car. That was it. No magical moments, no magical place, just an awkward question and a quick departure from the scene. All right. So later that night, I went to go make amends with my oldest sister. As I was driving to herself, to her car, that is, I couldn't help but remember the argument I had with my sponsor. I did not need to pursue amends with this person. She was 11 years older than me. She moved out of the house when I was 7, and she moved to another city to go to college. By the time she did come back, I had left the house. I'd moved thousands of miles away. She didn't even know me. How could she possibly deserve an amend? So I got to her house, and I did what my sponsor suggested, until again, the silence came. I remember as I went through that amend, before I got to the silence, I remember expecting to see her. What I expected to see her in her eyes was this idea, this vision of how noble her brother was, that he would even extend his pursuit of reconciliation to her who did not deserve it. That was what I expected until we got to the silence. With tears in her eyes, she expressed how angry and hurt the entire family was. All the stuff that my mom should have said, but didn't. She expressed that because of my total self-indulgence, there was extreme hurt. And this hurt extended through them to my sisters. She explained just how much she and my other sister hated me through all of this. I was shocked. I was humbled. I listened to my sponsor, and I sat there in silence. So those are just a couple of the amends that I went through, and they don't always turn out so well. Sometimes that amend is just the beginning of the pursuit of reconciliation. Before getting to those amends, I thought that I've gotten all there was to get from this 12-step framework. I thought that cup cleaning process was all there really was. It was so transforming and so profound in my life that I thought the rest was just a formality. But it turns out going through amends in this way was really, really transforming. It was amazing. And so to date, we've only talked about the first 9 steps of this framework. We've talked about what it means to start the journey of the heart's devotion to loving the Lord and your neighbor. These first 9 steps are actually at the heart of the 12-step framework. The remaining 3, 10, 11, and 12, actually get started before you even get to step 9, and they continue forever. Well, I kind of like that we're talking about these steps right now. We're not going to resume with 10, 11, and 12 until after the new year, but I like that it's at this point in the series that we're coming to a stop. At the point which focuses on the very reason that Christ came to be with us, to reconcile us to his Father, to be the example after which we model our own pursuit of reconciliation. I love that the next sermon you're going to be hearing is going to come on the very day itself that we focus on the joy of his birth, on the joy of his grace, on the joy of his mercy. So my family and I are not going to get to be here for that because, yep, I know, everyone's devastated. Because we're going to fly home to be with our families in Texas. So until then, I pray that you have a Merry Christmas. Thank you.